Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Twambo. No sound. If you are talking, we can't hear you. Let me see if other people
come. Can I be heard now?
Yes, you are.
Yes.
Loud and
clear. Ah, great. Okay, thank you. I figured out what the problem was. So I'm just going to give my intro again since I was speaking to myself before. Welcome to Zemi Blog Talk Radio. It's Saturday again. Thank you so much for joining us. If you are joining us from the U.S., it is morning and it's good afternoon from Germany. And if you are in Australia, it is evening. So thank you so much for joining us. Usually on Diaspora and Truth, I like to have a guest and talk about their different projects, what they're doing. But today we're going to do something a little different. We're going to have a roundtable discussion about different things that are happening in the world, you know, current affairs. What are our opinions? Is there something we can do or not? Is there something we can learn for Zambia? You know, they say you need to learn from what is going on from all over the world. So I'm to welcome Mr. Charlie all the way from Canada and Ms. Lucas from Missouri. Welcome to Diaspora and Truth today.
Good
Thank
morning
you.
And good
afternoon.
Great. So first of all, you know, I would like to just dive straight into what I think has been the most shocking for me that I've read in the news lately, and it's about the Sudanese woman who was sentenced to death for refusing to renounce her Christian faith. Now, for those of you that have not heard about the story, there's a Sudanese woman that was, you know, sentenced to death, and she was thrown into jail. She was 8 months pregnant, and she has since given birth to her child. And, you know, just reading the reports about what is going on, you know, there was pressure on her from Muslim religious leaders that she should return to the Muslim faith, though she says that she was never a Muslim, that her father was a Muslim, but she was brought up by her mother. And this is all coming against Sharia law, which considers her a Muslim and does not recognize her marriage to a Christian. Now, I would like to go straight to Canada and hear what Mr. Charlie has to say about this. What do you think?
It is another sad story, Twambo. Good morning again. Another sad story of, I think, what I would term was what social media is now able to do. It is an unearthing of the ugly aspects of some of these religions. We may have known what these religions have been able to do, but now we are seeing it firsthand what these religions are able to do. This woman was shackled while she was giving birth. The child, she has a 20 month child, a son, who was in jail with her. Which religion, on what grounds do people have to jail a human being just because they have said, I belong to a different faith than you want to? Pressure is mounting. I think they are going to reduce her, but more and more is, I think, what we are going to talk about today. This part of the world and this part of religion, how they treat their women is very, very sad.
And also, you know, in addition to her being, you know, sentenced to jail, she was supposed to receive, I'm not sure whether she has or not, but she's supposed to receive, you know, 100 lashes for the, you know, adultery
That's
conviction
correct.
That she was also given. Now, you know, for as much as we are living in the modern age, and there's different things that different religions have had to give up because they do not conform to the age that we live in. The question is, like I said, why should they continue to do things like jailing somebody for saying that they're not Muslim and then the, you know, 100 lashes to go with it? Miss Lucas, what were your thoughts when you heard this story?
Truly heartbroken. I had got a WhatsApp message to pray for her. I think, I'm not sure how widespread this was circulated, but when judgment was passed, messages were sent out to say, you know, pray for this lady, this is what's going on. And just as you described, you know, she's pregnant, and then on top of that, she has to be lashed. That is just absolutely uncalled for. You know, I have friends who are of the Islamic faith, and when you talk to them about this, they say this is not Islam. This is not what we preach or practice as Islam. Islam is peace. And, you know, I actually have a very close friend. She was a guest on the show on Mother's Day. She's a Muslim, but she has a lot of Christian friends and will have fellowship together. She's also, she's Sudanese as well. And, you know, discussing this with her, it really breaks our hearts collectively to say this is uncalled for. This kind of injustice is just doesn't make sense, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the big deal, the thing to understand here is that she is going against Sharia law. And basically, just to talk about what it is, Sharia deals with many topics addressed by circular law, including crime, politics, and economics, and as well as personal matters such as sexual intercourse, hygiene, diet, prayer, everyday etiquette, and fasting. So there are different, you know, variations of interpretations of Sharia between cultures as well. And it is the strictest and most historically coherent definition, and it is considered the infallible law of God. So as opposed to human interpretation of laws, Sharia law, they believe, is what God has said. And so this is why I think that they're being so strict towards this woman. Now, as Mr. Charlie has said, you know, there's been worldwide condemnation and pressure is mounting. Mr. Charlie, how do you think putting pressure on the government would help, you know, reverse this decision that they have made? What can we do? How can this be done?
When just like what is happening in Nigeria, when some of these governments, I think we reported here on Zambia Block Talk Radio, Bill Gates and the other people, they are saying as we move in the 21st century, we are going to see less and less dictators. Because of what the new media is able to do, so when a country is so to say brought in the daylight and the limelight is brought to them, right?
But what about, you know, like
the you know, we are talking about Sharia law and the how unfair it can be, especially to women. I think pressure is going to begin to mount. It's going to mount to all Islamic countries. You know, I want to agree with Ms. Lucas here, where Muslims say it is a peaceful Religion. I talked to this Nigerian fella I used to work with. No, you know, Islam is the is a peaceful religion. But I said to him, I said, so why is it that terrorism or terrorists are found in your face? You know,
mm-hmm.
We go to Nigeria, we go to Pakistan, we go to, they are all Muslims. So you
mm-hmm.
explain to me and help me understand how this faith is. So as we put this, I think this faith is now coming right in the limelight.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of pressure will be put to these people. What you are doing to human beings, you know, I have a video which was sent to me by Zebron. Very disturbing video. A woman, I think, was caught, it should be in some country, in Chad or something, in adultery, meant to dig her own hole. They were going to bury her alive, and they are singing all this Islamic. I'm like, what kind of God does things like this to his own? He is a loving God. Who is this God? He's only discriminative. Men are allowed to marry as many women as they want. I want to read that Sharia, which says that women, when they do wrong, they have to be punished in this way. So, again, we bring in social media, everyone else gets involved talking about this. I think it will put a lot of pressure in this government to begin to rethink how they applied some of these so-called Sharia laws.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you talked about these crimes against women. It seems that it may be on the rise. I don't know if it's on the rise or it's just because now we're more open to talking about crimes against women all over the world. Now that you mentioned, you know, this woman, this video that you saw of this woman in Chad who committed adultery and was told to dig her own grave. There was another story about a woman in Pakistan who was stoned to death. Now, she was pregnant. She was stoned to death. And this is these honor killings that they have in that part of the world where if they feel that their daughter has embarrassed them in some way, then the family has the right to stone her to death. And this young lady was stoned, this pregnant young lady was stoned to death because she refused to marry her cousin that they wanted her to marry, and she wanted to run off with somebody else that she loved in order to be married. Now, my question is, you know, yes, there's such a thing as Sharia law, and there's things like culture or, you know, these practices that we call our own. But is there a way that we can change people's mindsets to say women are actually people too, and these practices are harming them? What do you think, Ms. Lucas?
You know, even as you were formulating your question, and I was listening to Vachali describing the woman who was, you know, going to be stoned, the whole time I was thinking, okay, if she was caught in adultery, she's about to be punished. Where is the man? You know, who is the man also on the side digging his own grave there? Are they going to stone him? No, it's just the women. So you look at where do Muslims stand with in regard to gender? You know, how do they treat women? Have things changed? I'll diverge a little bit in answering that question. I do work with women in sports, and you find that it up to this, you know, recently 2 years ago, women were just now allowed to go to the gym in some countries, you know. And it took so much, you know, like maybe they had it to a point where women should not even be in exercising outfits. So for them to allow, even to open up a gym for them, they had to really consider what kind of clothes would they wear, will be men around, and so on. So that old ancient way of looking at women to say, okay, women are sexual objects. If you look at a woman, it will certainly arouse any man passing, so women should be fully covered from head to toe to avoid any kind of temptation and so on. That has to be, they really have to revise that, because the same men who want to pass this judgment, this Sharia law, are looking at the same women that they condemn and probably entertain them without, you know, in private. So they have to be honest about themselves, really have to be honest with themselves and not carry on something that is ancient.
Now, for a country like Zambia, which, you know, is a Christian nation, we do have people that practice the Muslim faith living in our country. And these are stories that we don't hear about happening in Zambia. Do you think that these are happening in private in our country and we just don't know about it? You know, these, I wouldn't say killings or so, because I haven't heard about them, but just the rampant abuse of women that seems to be the norm in the Islamic faith. Do you think this is happening in our country as well, and we just don't know? Mr. Charlie, what would you say about that?
How does it happen?
This may not happen right now because Sharia law. We had a segment here where we invited one of the ministers, so-called ministers from Lusaka, the Islamic faith. And one of the gentlemen who called into the radio, they have, I think, in the Muslim faith, what I think they call a quota population. If they are less than 10%, in any country, they are less than 10%, things like Sharia law may not have to be introduced in any country. They are taught to lie law and follow the laws of the land as they come. And once you have reached a certain number where you can be influential, then you can begin to introduce things like Sharia law. Having said that, our own women in Zambia were abused. When we received a lot of Senegalese who came back in our time, those Senegalese who came for emeralds, they were marrying 3, 4, 5 women at one house. And this is according to the Islamic faith, which is just fine. And some of these people were falling for it. One, because of money. Two, I don't know if our own women even understood these Islamic law. So they were falling for it. But whether it went to the extreme of even killing them or doing things like this, I'm not sure that used to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it was in private, and at that time, you know, we didn't have such a strong social media. It would be, of course, information being spread word by mouth and so on. But there were abuses, not necessarily killings, you know, that would, if they were, I didn't hear of them, but abusing where you can easily be neglected or burnt with oil because, you know, you are, I mean, most of the men who were Muslim at that time were not Zambians or were not black. If they were black, they were from other countries, you know. They'll be involved with a Zambian woman and maybe things go bad and they'll just abuse them in such a manner that you'd wonder how the relationship even started, you know, in the first place. So,
now,
you know, go ahead.
So I was going to say, you know, it's also very easy to, victimize is not the word I'm looking for, but it's what I can think of now. It would be very easy to point fingers and say, you know, that a lot of the times that it's mostly Muslim men that do this. But we do have Zambian men in our own communities that are not treating their women so well. So if we look at it in a holistic way, is it just ignorance that keeps, you know, societies from treating women in a correct way?
It is, absolutely.
I wouldn't say it is ignorance. Actually, that's a good question. I was thinking about it yesterday. I said to myself, why are women treated this way in the Islamic world? But then I started to think about the way we treat our own women. On top of the hour, Armstrong is from Washington State. The lead Zambezi God. They are doing honey there in Zambezi. One of the students is gone with wrote a story of how women are treated in Zambezi. Be in Zambezi, Ndulu, Zambezi, or Kasempa, where I come from, or anywhere. women do more work than men do. Men, you all go kumabala, you go together, you come home, they go to drink. Women, they'll go straight to fetch firewood, they go to fetch water to make sure there is food. There is that level of treatment of our own women in our country, which is acceptable, unfortunately, which is acceptable. Come to North America. There is another variation of the way women are talked about. You know, men, be white men or black men, the way women are talked about. So the whole issue of women, and probably one day we'll begin to agree with the feminist agenda to say, the whole issue of women, be in North America, be in Zambia, be, it is probably just a variation. Let Hillary Clinton, you know, one day choose to run as president. You are going to see how denigrating things which will be said about her because she is a woman. And we are talking about North America. We are not talking about some small rural village in Zambia. No, we're talking about North America. So in my view, it is just the variation. We are seeing this report.
That's where I absolutely agree that it's ignorance, you know. Things that have been going on for a long time, we are refusing to change. Information is presented before us, but we're refusing to change, make it better, or we don't really think that it's necessary to change the ways. As you have pointed out, actually, women have been, you know, men and women were working side by side in the field. But when they come home, the woman has to continue, working like a horse while the man has to rest, and the man will start demanding, you know, how come I don't have my water ready to take my bath? Where's the food? Why are the kids crying? Why is the house dirty? You are working side by side. Are you forgetting? But the information is there before you to say, if I'm tired, my friend is tired as well. You know, so I still stand on that ignorance. And it's a part that is not just played by men alone, even the women. Sometimes you'll be amazed, really amazed, shocked, disappointed, that there are women who will continue to talk to other women and say, that's the way you should go, continue life, that's the way it will be, and don't complain, just suck it up and move, you know, go with it. So... but there's the extreme of the feminist movement, the extreme of, you know, being that liberal that now the balance goes out of whack. What we the world needs is just finding that good balance. And also how two people get along. It starts from there, you know. The two can work it out. They are the example to the children. Hopefully it's happening in other homes.
But okay, I just wanted to go to the phone lines. We have a couple of questions or comments. I will go directly to area code 412, last number is 5167. Please go ahead with your question or your comment.
Hello?
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay, Simba here. I've been hearing what you guys are saying, and one time I met a Muslim woman in Washington, D.C., and I made friends with her. One thing, I'm a Christian, by the way, but one thing I've noticed about Muslim women, they're very respectable. They respect their men. That's one thing. And the opposite of what you guys are just talking about, women being abused, but also their men being abused as well. You can see some men don't respect themselves. I mean, some women don't respect themselves, and also they don't respect their men. So we must have a balance also. And I don't know if any of you have grew up in the village. I grew up in the village. When you're saying men go to work, yes, you do farming as you do, but my father used to go early before my mother woke up, okay? Start farming very early, and my mother would come with some food afterwards. And after, sometimes when they're done, my father would let my mother go back home, maybe to start cooking, but why is he still farming? Okay? Then when it comes to building a house, my father did not tell my mother to say, go build a house, go fetch the roof. My father did that. He lifted logs, heavy logs, as a man. So you must be able to have a balance. The African lifestyle, when you're telling these Europeans, you must be able to strike a balance how it's done. because sometimes it's taken out of books and say, well, women are being abused in, you know, in Soka or in Tanzania or in this place, but you must be able to strike a balance, the culture of it. How can it, if we upset it, how can it work? You see what I'm trying to say? So find them some balances. And also I think most of the women, they don't respect men. And sometimes they don't respect themselves. So the woman thing to me, like Sata was saying, he made women, you know, headquarters of police headquarters in Lusaka and Kitwe, women. And I disputed. It doesn't mean if women are not given jobs, pick whatever you pick just because they're women. Then, again, you are discriminating because it's a woman, you've picked them. Just because it's a woman, you've discriminated in any way. Pick a person who qualifies, not because she's a woman. So there must be a balance in all these things. It shouldn't just be woman, but there must be balance. A woman, to me, is a human being. So I would say every human being should be equally treated. But the word woman, I'm afraid that sometimes we use it way out of context. You say women are not educated enough. Women are not given enough money. Women, but you know what? If there are women who are on top of things, who are getting as much. So we shouldn't forget the other balance as well. I think to me that we must be able to strike a balance when we are talking about women, I think.
Okay. Now, I just wanted to ask you what your opinion is as far as what we discussed at the beginning of the show with this Sudanese woman that has unfortunately been jailed and she had to have her child, you know, whilst being chained, etc. What is your opinion on something like that?
Well, it's my opinion. Sorry, thanks you said that. It's my opinion. My opinion is that you must understand what's the background where she's in jail. What's the law there? What do they believe? What they believe in, and what have they been practicing? Because you know you can't, just as you can't go to Zambia or anywhere else and say bring some American things, that can't work. Even pure American democracy can't work. You know it can't. It just cannot. I'm not saying it will never work, but it can't just work when you bring it raw. It must be a way that it introduced and people start accepting it. You know what I'm talking about? And the other issues on the other end, like if you go to them and say, gay issues, oh, my God. You just certain things, yes, it's democracy, but certain things, certain cultures, it can't just work. So I think that if women, if I had a woman in a Muslim country, I would say, wear the way they wear long things, cover your face, follow those things. Then when you come out of there, you know, you can't just change things overnight. This is a religion. It's a belief these people are ready to die for, mind you. You and me, we believe in it. We're not ready. Are you ready to go to a Muslim country and say, you know what, you're abusing women, kill me if you want? None of us could do that. So what I always believe, if something you believe in you're not ready to die for, then forget about it. Simple as that.
So would you agree that it is okay to actually say, even if a country has a certain practice and a culture or a law that they've had for a long time, is it still okay to say this is wrong? Not that you want to go in and totally Americanize a place or change anything in one day. Isn't the part of the process of changing things speaking out against something that is wrong, even though it has been a culture for a long time?
I'll say one thing. So if you go somewhere, you start backing, you know, and you're not leaning against, you know, against anything else, you're going to fall sooner or later. So even the Americans know very well that they can't go to a Muslim country and just start, you know, bring these things. It can't work. And they know that even in Iraq, it can't just work. These people are grown up like this. You have to systematically start training these people, giving them a scholarship to America. Start training them little by little. They change. Will come, but it has to take a certain process. So so when I look at that, I'm not going to rush in and say, well, you know what, this, yes, you can say it's bad, but just Mary saying it's bad is not helping another woman who is going to be jailed. So the process has to be, you know, slower, but sure, it's going to change. How long did it take for even slavery in America to end? It took a long, long time. Even amongst Christians, you know, saying people, you know what I'm trying to say? You know, these are the things that we should be able to be very, very careful when we look at it. And the one question I'll give the panel, I want to ask a question. Why did Jesus Christ not pick women when he was picking disciples? So that's a question I have been troubled with. I want you to think about that. Why he didn't? Was he discriminating against women?
He had a lot of disciples. It's not just the 12.
when he picked the first twelve, why did amongst the first twelve that he picked, why didn't he pick women?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is an interesting question, Mr. Charlie. Do you have anything to say about what has been said?
Of course I do. The first question you talked about Twambo is how you asked Mr. Simbaya what it means with what is happening in Pakistan, and us probably that's the impression that Simbaya is giving us. It's like no, let's not talk about. I'm paraphrasing this question, but don't get me wrong. Let's not talk about this. These are some of the laws. These are some of the norms which are acceptable. When you think about, let's talk about gay issues. That's a little bit, gay issues. When you think about homosexuality in Zambia, we have this image of a white person who goes to Zambia, probably go after boys there. But these are our own people. These are our own brothers who are doing these things. We may not accept it, but these are our own brothers. Mm. Why should we as a nation arrest them, put them in jail for this? Because we, as a society, we have said it is unacceptable. Why should they be in jail? I may disagree with it, definitely 100% disagree with it, but is putting them in jail the right thing or the right thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
But Simbaya compares the man's job, Kumushi wa Simbaya. I know you grew up Kumushi. I know we like Kumushi for one part of my life. You cannot compare the work the women do. Yes, a man can build a house. My uncles or my brothers would build a house. You build a house once in 5 years, you know. Yes, the men will go to the fields and but on the day-to-day work, they have to go fire mesh, valet a mesh. They have to go fetch firewood, valet the firewood. They have to find while he is seated. You cannot underplay that, Masimbaya. That cannot be underplayed. That if men, for instance, with proper education, we became part and parcel of our own women in the villages, this is why we find women are most likely to be uneducated. Why is it that Pamushi... Let's say Havana, but it's for five, but it's 10 Havana, or the same village, same age. Havana 4, they are more likely to go to school than Havana 2. Why is that? We are talking about this because, one, we are enlightened. We have seen that even girls can, well-natured, even girls can, go higher class. Why did Jesus pick only 12 disciples who were men? Let's call Jesus, he was blameless, but probably he was wrong.
But don't the last question on Jesus picking the 12 men, but remember on his resurrection, the first person he spoke to was a woman. He sent a message through a woman. That's
all right. So
No. That's besides the point. Let's not agree to that. Agree here that even ourselves, the reason why we have so less of our own children. Ms. Lucas asked a question here. The girl who was found doing adultery was being sentenced to die. The question was, where is adultery? Where is the man doing wrong with? What kind of law in 21st century should be accepted as a law of the land, which says a woman should go and die, a man should survive in 21st century? What kind of the law says the boy should go to school, the girl should not be going to school? It happens in our own villages. when a girl in Zambia gets pregnant, she's most likely to stop school than the boy who she got pregnant with, you know, who made her pregnant. Why is that? These are some of the things we, the enlightened, in 21st century, should be talking about. Forget that Jesus Christ stuff, why did he put this? We are in the 21st century. Let's put solutions on the table.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'd just like to go to the phone lines now. We have a question or a comment from Mr. Jisewe. Mr. Jisewe, please go ahead with your question or your comment.
Yes, I have a comment, Tambo. Good morning and great discussion again. I hope that someday people have gone who are in diaspora, the governments and the learning institutes institutions in Africa, someday they will pay attention to things that are troubling us because of visiting, seeing other places, how they live and how they let the children or even the adults enjoy life. And when it comes about, when we are talking about mistreating others, we are talking about the women and how some religious or religion institutions, they said women can't do this and stuff like this, you know. And there's a great materials. And I'll be honest, when we read about I'm not a scientist, but when you read about science, you know, how you understand what, you know, how the brain works, what makes us, you know, act a certain way because of the first thing you experience in life. And your brain will put it, try to remember it, you know, that's how you go out. And you guys, when you get a chance, if you get a chance, read about Five Agreements, you know, the book which says Five Agreements, you know. It has helped me to understand life and the way we use symbols and the way we try to program the children and they get a certain age, and I'm just saying this, Twombo, I hope that, you know, that institution they will learn. But the troubling thing is how we grew up, you know, they had out sometimes the way they made the children work, even the governments, like for me right now, I used to hate when a government official come to my school and they will make you leave school because you are a child to go and see them coming to welcome them for what? You know, just like we are talking about, why should a man make a woman dress because you can't control your... I'm saying it lightly, Twombo, but these things should be discussed about because I'm not born to save someone because I'm short, and because I'm tall or because I'm made this way and I should be a subject to someone else. It's something that we should be challenging. We should challenge and we should talk about, you know, because it's a precious gift, you know, to be born and to breathe. I'm not going to be born and be put these feelings for me to be subject to someone because I'm a woman, and when you come, just sit, and I'm going to save you food. For what? Go get, it's lightly, Twombo, don't get me wrong. When I go to a restaurant and I'm paying for my service, you know, I need to be saved because I'm paying for service. I can't just walk to the restaurant and sit because I'm a woman or I'm a man or because, I don't want to offend anybody. I just want to see, I don't know how I can explain. Or because I'm a beautiful dark-skinned person, then everyone should walk away when I'm coming in the room. No, you know, there's a reason. Maybe when we go to a model show, you know, then that's nice clothing, because that's, you know, but not when we are just because these things are
very troubling. Well, Mr. Tisa, I get the point that you're trying to make, and that we should be asking questions. Why are things the way they are? And this is exactly what we're trying to do on this show today.
And Twombo, before, let me just make a quicker. I mean, because there's something I should have written down. you know, now I lost my train of thought here. I'm just saying, you know, like even churches and stuff like that, it's these things that should be listened to, because churches have made us to be what we are, and it's something that makes our community strong. But right now, because of science and everything else, we need to change too, you know,
mm-hmm.
so that way we don't lose our people and we don't lose the things that we have treasured, you know, growing up, like especially like, mm-hmm. like right now, church and computer and science, they're coming, you know, and it's something that we should look and we should talk about. Okay, Twambo, but thank you for the opportunity. And I'm just going to encourage, especially diaspora, that we should be talking about things like this, you know.
All right. Thank you so much for your contribution. I appreciate it. I'm going to go quickly to the next caller, and this is area code 913, last number is 2282. Please, sorry to ask you, but everybody, if you could just speak a little faster, we're running out of time on the show. So please go ahead with your question or your comment about our subject today.
Hey, Twambo, thanks so much for letting me speak. I just had to quickly express my view. I think the women problem is, I look at it as more like a global problem. You know what I'm saying? It's a global culture that has been there for a very long time. If you look way back, either here in the United States, where women were not allowed to vote, you know, their rights were not all that valued, to even right now where the United States has had so many presidents, no, none of them has been a woman or something, you know. So that means I remember very well when I was watching the elections of Barack Obama campaigning versus Hillary Clinton, even white folks would be saying bros over hoes. That means, or rather, they don't really like to vote for a black man, but they're going to vote for a black man because he's a brother instead of voting for, you know what I'm saying? So that's been a global trend for a very long time. If you go back, if you go back to Zambia, you know what I'm saying, even the culture that we have that I've really looked at it, that has really been contributing to all this, is a culture of Lobola, you know what I'm saying? Why, for me, the Lobola culture has been the one that has really been prompting men to act all this weird and disrespect the women. Because if I want to marry you, you know what I'm saying, in Africa, why do I have to pay your parents some money so that I can keep you? People get pissed off for that. Pretty much it's more like I'm buying you. Okay, you are my property. That's how I look at it. Mm-hmm. Okay, if I come and say, okay, I know it's a good culture, it's our culture, we have to preserve it, but that culture has a bad mentality towards the guys. Sometimes you have to charge me like maybe $5 million, or I mean 5 million kwacha or something, to marry someone. Once I marry that someone, I'll take that someone as a property. If you look at way back in the slave trader days, if you buy a person as a slave, you know, that's a property. So it means you'll be doing what you have to do to them, because that's a property.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at all this, and even right now, if you look at...
Please make it quick with everyone. We're running out of time. Sorry.
Okay. You know, and just quickly, just my last point, the trend of, like, for example, if I'm trying to date somebody and something like that, and then, you know, they expect the guy to, you know what I'm saying, to be the one in charge, or pick a place, or buy the dinner, pay for all that, and stuff like that. That means pretty much like the guy is having all that ownership to everything, and then he's going to have that mentality of like, okay, I own this, and hence they're going to be like, oh, misusing, whatever. So what I'm trying to say quickly is that there's just some few cultures that need to change, the trends that need to change for us to start, changing what's going on towards the women, the abusing and stuff like that. So.
All right. Thank you so much, Zebrin, for your comment. I'm going to go to another caller that we have, area code 314, last numbers 4644. Please go ahead with your comment.
Well, in America, you may not buy the woman up front, but you sure do pay for her in the end. And I think that as Zambians have a problem with their culture and the traditional things that go on, and also other countries, it should be up to those countries and those people to make those changes, and not from outside influence, because I have seen outside influence be played out in a very demonic way. And you're talking about women's rights. You know, in Germany, it's illegal to homeschool. And Germany is a NATO partner, the United States, and also a trade partner. But you don't hear any human rights abuses being imposed on those countries. They always want to impose them on other countries, Asians and Africans.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I think that the cultures and with this particular case in Sudan, which I'm not very privileged on, but I think that if you have certain elements in your culture, then it's up to the people of those countries to make those changes and not outsiders.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your comment, Pianki. Mr. Charlie, just to wrap up this subject we're talking about the lady from Sudan, and we talked about, you know, the woman in Pakistan. Should we just wrap this up? What do you have to say so we can move on to the next story that is in the papers that we can talk about?
Twambo, can I ask one question, just to throw out a question there? It may require an answer or not. But, you know, when we look at the Sudanese woman, this woman is grown. Her parents have known she's been of this faith. So I think there's much more to read. Either there might be an ulterior motive for this to suddenly come up. It's not like she suddenly converted. She was a Christian for a while. So I guess the question I'm trying to ask, you know, what else do we know about the story? I think there's more to it's more of a revenge kind of a thing that, you know, this woman is being punished. But over to you, Vachali.
Just a short one to Brother Pianki's assertion that countries probably or cultures should be left alone. Unfortunately, 21st century Pianki has brought the global community together. What we may say as acceptable here, which 100 years ago was not acceptable in Zambia, unfortunately, the global society, the global community is saying there should be a human element in everything we do, whether it is in Malaysia, whether it is in Lusaka, whether it is in Russia. There should be a human element in everything we do. Thank you, Twambo. I think we can go to the next one.
Okay, so the next topic that I thought that we could discuss, I was talking to Mr. Charlie earlier about what we can talk about. Something else that came up was also, you know, the issue of Boko Haram, which is still going on. Since we've been talking about, you know, Islam and the issues that we've been having with the terrorists being mostly of Islamic faith, or people that are terrorists could be pretending that they're Muslim. I'm not sure about that. But what do we know about Boko Haram? How far does their, you know, network extend? Why is it important to talk about this? I mean, I know people are tired of hearing about terrorists. They were tired of hearing about Al-Qaeda. Boko Haram is Africa's Al-Qaeda, is Nigeria's Al-Qaeda, and they're doing a lot of damage. And they've been doing it for much more than we've heard before the Bring Back Our Girls campaign. So I just wanted to find out, Mr. Charlie, we've talked about Boko Haram before, you know, on my show. We talked about the Bring Back Our Girls campaign. Nathan spoke about it as well on his show. According to what you have read about Boko Haram, what are your thoughts on it? What do you think can be done? And where do we stand as Africa? And not talking about the U.S. coming in to find the girls, you know, Nigeria's position, Zambia's position. Is there anything we can do? What can we be wary of? What can we learn?
Boko Haram, Twambo, I'll send a link, I think, on my website, on my Facebook. Maybe Pianki can have a look at that. There is a book which has been produced by a Nigerian lady who has explained Boko Haram, yes, maybe Islamic faith, but Boko Haram, like we have said on this show, and we have said it last week, this kind of thinking is happening in our own country, in Zambia. This kind of thinking is happening in Congo. This kind of thinking is happening all over world, all over Africa. Boko Haram is one of those things which have flourished well, because of poverty. North Sudan, North Nigeria, where are these things are happening, is an abandoned place. Abandoned. That's what this lady writes in the book. Now that because of these ladies have been abducted, and it's bringing the limelight to this area. Nigeria has, this is a lost place. No one has paid any attention. And now Boko Haram has come and has filled that vacuum. Yes, they may belong to to Islamic faith. But this one is one of those things which is waiting to manifest itself in Zambia, where rural areas of Zambia may be producing a lot of wealth for the country, but that wealth is just benefiting the people in the line of rail, especially those in the capital. So Boko Haram is two-faced. Yes, there's an element of religion to each Swambo, but it is mostly the element of poverty which has brought Boko Haram. That having said that, you cannot go and abduct your own children. This is an Islamic area. This is their own children. You cannot go and abduct your own children to express what your interests or whatever they are. Bring back those children. We're still going to demand that. It is a normal thing to do than imprisoning the young girls.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems that it's almost becoming the norm now to hear about terrorist attacks in Africa. You hear about Boko Haram in Nigeria. You hear now about, Al-Shabaab in Kenya. You know, in Nairobi, there's been lots of embassies that have pulled out their staff. And now nobody even talks about bombings in Kenya anymore. It's almost become normal that, oh, that's what's happening. Right now our focus is on Boko Haram and bring back our girls. But there's been blasts that have been going on in Kenya that they're also trying to deal with. Is it because we just have not been trained to deal with terrorism, and that is why it seems so hard for us to deal with right now? I mean, every country has to have its first experience with terrorism before really knowing how to handle it. But it seems like a trend that the terrorist attacks are flourishing in Africa. Does this tie in with your opinion on poverty?
Yes, 100%. Again, where Boko Haram, we're talking about Boko Haram, northern Nigeria, a very, very poor place. The manifestation of terrorists who are going to Kenya are mostly coming from where? Somalia, a failed state, very, very poor country. So poverty is driving a lot of this. We have Muslims in the United States. We have Muslims here in Canada, Twambo. They cannot influence so many people to follow them because everyone is busy living well, so to say. But when you go to a country like Zambia, where the 10% are well-to-do, in the middle there is nobody and everyone else is poor. Someone who will come with an ideology like Boko Haram, who will inflict our feelings about government, people may just follow them. It has everything to do with poverty. I agree with you 100%.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, this will be very interesting to watch, especially for any African country where you have, the Islamic faith or you have people that are Muslims, to watch and see if other countries are sort of formulating a way in which they can be prepared for such attacks. Do you think a country like Zambia, Kenya is not so far away from Zambia, do you think that we are having people in our administration that are looking at this situation and saying, how are we being prepared for it? Do they just think that it's something that could not happen at all?
Again, I think prevention, as they say, is better than cure. For us, we shouldn't be preparing, so to say, if a bombing happened in Zambia, what would we do? The preparation which should start today, if there is one thing which moves me every day to want to go back to my own country, it is to go and mobilize rural Zambia, where people can find out what they can do with their own pineapples in Mwinilunga, what people in Katete can do with their mangoes. When we can force our elected members, when we can force our culture, our own cultures to stop looking to Lusaka, so to say, and develop the rural areas, the jobs and everything, the standard of living go up, that is the best prevention of these things we are talking about. If we are going to be prepared of how many ambulances we have, how many hospitals, how many soldiers we are going to have, Nigeria is the most populous nation in the world. They are failing to deal with a very small population which has gone well. They are failing to do that. Why? Mm-hmm. Because the whole region has bought into the idea that they are abandoned and they cannot mm-hmm. look to Lagos or Abuja. They cannot look to them. And it has become a thorn in the government of Nigeria. So the best prevention, in my view, the best prevention of how to prevent these things growing out of proportion in our own country, let's take development to Kasempa. Let's take development to Chiruvi. Let's take development to Lundazi in the rural areas. Then no one can come and teach them. They'll say, we are minding our own business. We have things to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much, Mr. Charlie. Another thing that I would like to talk about now is Joyce Banda no longer being the president of Malawi. We now have Peter Mutharika, who is a former foreign minister of Malawi and was sworn in as Malawi's new president on Saturday after defeating Joyce Banda. But it was a bitter and chaotic election. And especially for those that have been watching the election, one of the outcries was basically that Joyce Banda was trying to hold on to power, and people were disappointed because they felt that because she was a woman, if she was defeated, then she would most likely walk away from her position with more grace, but that didn't happen. Mr. Charlie, what were your thoughts reading this story about Mama Joyce Banda?
It was... My first thought or comment was that, oh, Africa, here we go again. You know, you cannot just accept defeat as something which has happened. And as we spoke about it last week, we said what the Malawian people are going to do, we will send a signal even to our own PF, who have shown the signs of wanting to stick to power by all means. And mm-hmm. our friends, we congratulate the Malawians for standing by and not accepting this kind of nonsense. So to say the elections are now and void, this and this, those are your stories. So that is mm-hmm. a lesson we are taking from Malawi. Yes, a country may be described as docile, so to say. Mm-hmm. You know, people who cannot react. Yes, mm-hmm. we cannot react as the Americans would say, carry a big stick, but is it speak softly, but with a big mm-hmm. stick. This is what the Malawians have done. PF, this is your message. Zambians may not speak loudly, but we have a big mm-hmm. stick, and we know that.
Mm-hmm. It was really interesting on Twitter. There was somebody that was tweeting about the political similarities between Zambia and Malawi, you know, and they were saying it seemed that where Zambia leads, Malawi seems to follow. So they had all these tweets giving all these facts, which I will just read out. And if any of them are wrong, please feel free to correct me. It says both Zambia and Malawi were part of Britain's Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland from 1953 to 1963. Both Zambia and Malawi gained independence in 1964, July and October, respectively. The parents of Zambia's first president came from Malawi. Both Kamuzu Banda and KK declared themselves life presidents in the early 70s. Banda remained in power for 30 years and Kaunda for 27 years. Multi-party democracy was reintroduced to both Malawi and Zambia in the early 90s. Muluzi and Chiluba in office, 91 and 94 respectively. Both were born in 1943, ruled for 10 years, and faced serious corruption charges after leaving office. Both third presidents, Levy and Bingu, were handpicked by their predecessors. Both died in office, and both were replaced by a Banda. Both Bandas served only one term, losing elections to the main oppositions. Both now have new leaders, Sata and Mutharika, who have both previously served in the government. So when I was reading this, I found it really, really interesting because it sounds like it's almost the same thing. And now people are talking about, is Mutharika going to be Malawi's next Michael Sata? And should they be worried? What is your opinion, Mr. Charlie?
I'm not sure I know Mutharika that well. Although his father, I think by the time he was being thrown away, he was not very, very popular for some reasons. So I may not really comment on Mutharika in that sense. But on other similarities, yes, I think one huge similarity is that we are not very violent countries. Malawi and Zambia seem to be, you know, one strange thing about Malawi that at one point, Twambo, I used to think Malawi was part of Zambia. It was a province of some sort. Because we had all these Tumbukas who came from Malawi working in the mines. They were our brothers and sisters. I never even knew they came from a different country. Up to this day, I think Malawi still remains part of Zambia and our cultures. Very calm people. But what we are showing Africa, what we are showing the entire world, is that, yes, we may be docile, but don't take our docility for granted. That is one thing I think which is very common to these two countries.
Mm-hmm. So what can we do as Africans to deter from what happened to, say, Joyce Banda from happening, where there's elections and then because somebody is not winning, you ask for a recount, and just this grasping for power, to stay into power? It seems that this is a problem that we have continuously in Africa. What can we as the voters do, you know, other than showing up and voting and then having all these problems with, oh, there was something wrong with the ballot boxes, oh, we need a recount, et cetera. Is there something we can do as Africans to prevent these problems during elections, especially for leaders who want to stay in power?
There is, and we are doing it. We talked about it when it comes to Islamic faith. Are the things which happen in the Islamic faith, are they new, or we knew about them even a long time ago? Social media has come in today. Things are being reported instantly as they happen. We have our own issue of our president not being well. Before, maybe we would not even have known what is happening. But by the press on the button on the cell phone, someone can send messages to the entire world. The cell phone, social media is keeping up with these politicians, whether they like it or not. Sunshine has to prevail in most of these our government. So we have to put pressure. Let's not forget the Americans have had free independence for almost 300 years. They can't even get their elections right. So we are doing the best we can do. The pressure we are putting, Twambo, every morning we wake up with the Bianchis of this world, the Zebrons, the Simbayas. We come every day and make our little noise. Trust me, this noise adds up to one and two, and we are putting pressure on most of these governments to do the right thing. PF, whether they like it or not, you are listening this morning, whether you like it or not, PF, when time for you to come, to go, has come, you will leave. You will go, whether you like it or not. That's what I can promise you from Mogo Talks here.
Okay, I would just like to go to the phone lines now and hear what people have to say about what we have said, especially about the leaders, the similarities between Zambia and Malawi, and about Joyce Banda wanting to stay in power, and African leaders that do not want to leave. Ms. Lucas, are you there? Can you please let us know what your opinion is on our subject right now?
I'm here. Thank you, Twambo. I was following the news with Joyce Banda, and when she had asked for the recount, it's amazing to see the people's responses, A lot of people were trying to say, she's power hungry, she's really holding on to this thing. But it looks at something that's deeper than that. If a person is asking for a recount, how many African countries have asked for recount? That's because the system is not put in a way that we can trust it, I remember when Chiluba had his elections back in 96 or somewhere there. Immediately, I think even before the results were out, there were rumors of ghost voters and rigging, rigging elections and so on, So there's something that we have to look at, and it's not just because Mama Banda lost the elections or anything like that, but how are the systems that we have in place throughout our African countries that has to be looked at. Very rare times do you hear of a recount here in the United States, or in the European countries. So something has to be done. But I wanted to, oh my gosh, just like that, I've lost my train of thought. I will end here. When I remember, I'll come back.
Okay. All right. I'm just going to go to the phone lines and find out if anybody else has an opinion about Mama Banda and about, African leaders hanging on to power. I will go to Pianki and see if he's available. Pianki, do you have anything to say about Joyce Banda? Were you following the story?
No, I wasn't following the story about Banda. I can understand in some cases why African leaders want to hold on to power, but you also have to also look at the opposition and who's actually funding the opposition. Mm-hmm. You also, you know, my comments. My comments is always a comment of I'm very cautious. So I hope everything works out fine. I can understand why, but it shouldn't be. Things have to change.
All right. Thank you. And if you have any more questions or comments about what we are talking about right now, if you'd just like to join the conversation, please go ahead and press 1 on your keypad. This is Zambia Block Talk Radio. We're having a roundtable discussion about different things that are happening in the world, what is going on in the news. And then later on, we're going to have Mr. Charlie connect his guests. And they're from Washington State, currently in Zambezi. You know, they're looking at what is going on there and how they can work well there. Mr. Charlie, do you have your guests connected?
Yes, Wambo, and thank you for a very enlightening discussion there on what is happening world over regarding all sorts of things. But this morning, we cross over to Zambezi, where we are going to discuss with Josh Armstrong. Josh Armstrong is a professor, I would say, in Washington State. He's going to tell us which school. They have a project running in Zambezi, building a library, and they're using the local resources, the local people. Josh, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. It's great to be speaking to you from Zambia.
Yes, it is great. A good friend of mine gave me your link, and I read about the things you are doing in Zambia, in Zambezi. Let me ask you, Josh, how did you come to find out about Zambezi?
Well, Gonzaga University, where I teach, is a Catholic Jesuit school, and the Jesuits have been involved in Zambia for many, many years. In fact, many Zambian of the priests who have worked for us at our university have spent time in Zambia, and so we've had a long history. And then we were looking for a new program for some of our students for them to be able to learn and grow from the people here. And at that same time, some priests were shifting to Zambezi in the northwestern province, and they said we'd love to start a partnership with Gonzaga University. So that was 2007. And we've been bringing students here each year since then. So I believe this is our eighth year of spending time, about 4 weeks in Zambezi, working on various projects with the people here.
Oh, wow. From 2007, that is a long time.
Now, when I arrive here in Zambia, they say you're not a visitor, you're a resident here, and so I feel like this is my home as well.
Yes. I mean, I read on your Facebook page how you travel there every. You don't wait May to come to go back to Zambia. What makes you to have this very strong and interesting connection with that part of Zambia?
I think it's a town that's growing right now. The Northwest province is definitely growing, and you'll find in Solwezi and other places that the mines are making those towns quite big. But Zambezi, it's seen some progress, but it's still a small place, a place where I can come and walk through the market and still see many friends who connect myself and my students to different projects. And so we've also found it to be a place where people are very hardworking and entrepreneurial, and they want to really have us come alongside them as they stand on their own 2 feet. And so that's most of our projects have been, how do we empower Zambians to do the things that they know how to do best? And maybe we can come and assist them and give them just maybe one leg up on that project. And the Zambia Honey Project was one of those that's been an outstanding example of that.
Mm. Talk about the project, Josh, you are doing in Zambezi. What are they? What type of projects are you doing in Zambezi?
Well, the longest project has been the Zambia Honey Project, where we're helping local beekeepers who are in you know, co-ops, helping them get some of their product to the U.S., and we're selling honey, and I'm sure we could talk more about that project. We could talk for hours about the things that we've learned and Zambians have learned through that project. But while we're here, we're also doing projects in computer lessons, leadership and business planning and sustainability. We have a literacy project in a local rural school, and then we also have some health educators, some nurses and students who are going to be studying medicine who come and do local teaching around health education.
That is interesting. We are going to talk about honey for a little bit, because I think we are interested in how this is done. But from the perspective of building leadership skills or helping the local people, from 2007 to this day, how have you gauged their progress in as far as either productivity is concerned regarding honey? I don't know if you're working on that, or in your marketing strategy. How are people done from 2007 to today?
What I've loved is that it's been small projects. The library that we've completed and that we're working on with a local school is probably one of our bigger projects, but most of the things are small projects that have a huge impact on the person that's proposed those. So you'll have somebody who will start a citrus farm, or somebody who will start a tomato farm, or brick making. And these are all things that they've come up with in our leadership courses and that they themselves are then implementing. So we'll come back the next year and we'll find that somebody has taken some of the lessons in our business courses and used that to have a proposal to maybe get a loan or to start a business. And you'll find them thriving in that business. And we can only take a small part of the credit for that, really, because we've just turned the light on for them. I'm thinking about a project right now. It's really been about an engineering project. So we're looking at how to make a better stove, a stove that's more fuel efficient, but also it's a stove out of local materials. And so we've been using bricks, and we have a few engineering students who have been teaching people here about heat generation and how that works. And I think more than anything else, what I feel like we've done is just flip the switch for Zambians to say, oh, I didn't realize that we could use this and this and have a stove work. And then they're taking that same idea and creating more innovation that we would never have thought of. And so we walk away from the stove and we come back and they've done this, this, and this, and then they've made it even better. And so it's been pretty remarkable to be partners with people here and to see the work that they're doing.
If you were to quantify how many people have been affected positively with your program, and say in terms of graduates, those who have graduated, how many people do you think you have impacted with your program, so to say?
Yeah, I think each year the computer classes are probably, we teach probably 3 to 4 classes, and each class maybe has 15 to 20 students in it. And then our leadership classes, we teach one in the morning and one in the afternoon, and those are usually probably about 20 students in each one of them. So you take those numbers and you combine that over the last 7 or 8 years, and you find that you can have a huge impact on a community. But our purpose is not really to count up all the numbers of the people. It's really to make a meaningful impact on a smaller number and to empower them. And so we'll often even find students who've taken the computer lessons the year before, they'll come back and they'll want to take the advanced lesson. Or you'll find someone who's done 2 years or 3 years of the leadership classes because each year they find that they're learning something else about their businesses that they're starting.
The library you are building, according to what is written on the website, you are using the local resources again, honey, which is being sold in the United States. The profits are going back to build the library. What are the plans for this library other than the books? How big is it? What is it going to do in terms of technology, stuff like that, in the local region?
Yeah, this has been a project that we've been working on maybe for 3 or 4 years. When we started selling honey in the U.S., we said we want to pay beekeepers a fair rate at the front end.
Yeah.
So maybe they can't sell their honey in just in Zambezi, but maybe we can give them a rate that's going to be more than they can receive just here in the Northwest Province. But then on the back end, after we sell the honey, we want all the proceeds to come back to this region, because as a university, we're not really interested in making a profit for ourselves. The experience that our students get in selling it is really what's the benefit for us. And so we've been able to bring back, I think our sales may be $4,000 to $6,000 a year, depending on the year, in honey sales, and all that money comes back to this community. And so one of the first projects that the local community said was that we believe a library in the north, in the Zambezi district, would have a huge impact on literacy, and there isn't currently no library in this area. And so we have about 20,000 books that will be coming to the library that's completed now, and we're thinking that the books themselves will be here maybe in the next 6 months. But the impact that will have on the school and on the adults and the learners in this area, I think, will be radical. In fact, one of the teachers just recently told us that, the biggest event in her mind was the independence of Zambia. The second biggest event in her mind was the opening of this library.
Mm.
I'm not sure about that, but I thought that they're quite excited about what we're doing in the community with them.
Well, I agree. I agree, Josh, that this morning we were talking about, disturbed places of Africa. And one of those problems or symptoms is poverty. And when people are able to read, find new ways of doing things, that is the best which can happen to any country. But talk to us about the honey. So how do you take the honey from Zambezi to the United States? In what form? How do you package it to be sellable to the North American market?
Yeah, so the honey here, we're in a region where people speak Lunda and Nuvale, and so they call the honey Uchi. So we take the honey out of local beekeepers, and, a beekeeper might end up having anywhere from 20 to maybe even 80 or 100 different hives. And they collect those hives and bring them to different distribution centers. So I'm sure there's some in Zambezi and Kabompo. Inilunga is a very popular place for the honey to be processed. Then it's collected in large drums and exported to the U.S. where it's processed and put into packaging that then we can sell. And we're currently, I think it's 12-ounce packages. And they're maybe even recently, I think they're 13 ounces, and they're quite attractive packaging.
Yes.
They tell a little bit of the story of the people here, Zambia Gold Honey, and we're selling them for $10 U.S. and still able to, maybe take $4 to $5 of that money and bring it right back here to the community.
And how much honey are you, first and foremost, taking per year to the United States? Second, is that the potential, or you can take even more honey to come and process here in the United States?
Yeah, I think we made an order last year where we purchased maybe, I think for us was maybe the value of it was almost $30,000 worth of honey that then we have in our storerooms at Gonzaga, and we've made quite a dent into that amount of honey. And, we're selling it in Spokane. We're selling it online, so if people are interested, they could go to www.zambiagold.org, and on that you can actually order the honey. And what we find is that sometimes we'll get people who have just spent some time Googling Zambian honey because either they themselves are Zambian or they visited Zambia and they want to taste this unique honey again, or often it's family members of students who have traveled here or others who are looking for unique organic honey. I mean, it's very difficult to find organic honey in the U.S., and so that's also a market. And so we're finding new ways to be selling it, and I think that's one of the great experiences that our students are getting as well. They come here, they spend time with beekeepers, they see how it's collected out of these logs that are up in a tree, and then they have a chance to tell those stories in different ways. In fact, I do have a student here who maybe could even share a little bit about his own experience, if you're interested, if we have time, to hear from him about the lessons that he's learned along with working with beekeepers here. And
oh, definitely, we will. We will. There's one student, I was reading the stories, amazing stories. I'm sure we have. One of the things that once you come back here in Washington, I think you and I are going to talk, because what we are thinking about, Josh, is how the Zambians who listen to us, more than 30,000 Zambians listen to this broadcast every Saturday. We can make we can support our own market in Zambia, and probably we can build even more libraries. Honey is a specialty of Northwestern Province to begin with. Although the whole country produces honey, but Northwestern Province produces a lot of it. So when you come back, Josh, I'll definitely be in touch to see if we can order in bulk and start distributing in our own local places where we are.
No, that would be excellent. I mean, we're wanting to partner with anyone, and what we like about the project so much is it's not just somebody asking for a handout or for us to say, please donate to this project. Really, we're selling just amazing honey, honey that many of your listeners would be very familiar with, and yet we're not in it to get anything out of it besides the experience and the education. And so we're first and foremost interested in helping the partners that we've become such good friends with here. And so each one of those bags of honey, not only do you get to taste that Zambia gold, but you also get to make a contribution by buying it from meaningful projects like the honey and library projects. So.
Oh, great, great, great. Well, once you are here, I'll definitely be in touch. Okay, maybe before you go, I'll let you go and bring in the other one. I may let one or two people who have called in here just ask you one or two questions. Twambo, do you have any question for Josh Armstrong, who is in Zambezi this morning?
Yes, it's a very interesting project. I actually have not heard of it, and this is the first time I'm hearing about it. And I'm actually looking at the website, and I'm really interested in how you have packaged the honey. It looks really, really nice. I like those little plastic, you know, things you have, and they have the lid on it, which makes it easy for the honey to be poured. Now, my question was, you ship the honey to the U.S. in drums to be packaged. Is it not possible to open some sort of packaging plant in the Northwestern Province where the packaging could be done? Does it have to be sent to the U.S.?
Yeah, I think we've been working with other partners who have helped us with that aspect of it. And so some of those the specific questions about how to do that, maybe something that we would ask our other partners who help us with some of the exporting and importing. I think part of it has to do with we really value the USDA organic certification so that people know that the honey that they're getting is organic and has been certified. And I think some of that has to do with the way that it's packaged and bottled. You know, before we have the current packaging, we had little glass jars that we sold. And then we moved to the current packaging because we felt like it was a little bit easier to ship. And quite frankly, it's a little easier to use. The jars looked really nice, but these packaging now that have like a little bit of an edge on them, you can squirt them into your tea in the morning, or I often use it on my toast, or you know, so many other ways that it's become more user friendly. And so we're really happy with how attractive they are. And when you see them, you know, you also think about the Zambezi, the mighty river that. That flows through so much of Zambia and that so many of us have fond memories of.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like you mentioned, being able to certify the honey as organic. And so Zambia, I guess, does not have the power yet to certify the honey as organic. Otherwise, you would then package it in Zambia.
Yeah, I think and there may be other complications in terms of even shipping them in that way. You know, they end up going into drums and then containers and then shipping all the way over there. And so I'm not sure about that and even whether the equipment to be able to do that is available in the Northwest Province at this point. I know that one of the biggest processing areas ends up happening for us in Minilunga, which is north of us, and then also in Kabumpo, which is just east of us. And so, but in Zambezi currently there isn't a processing plant for honey.
Oh, okay. Great. Yeah, those are the questions that I had. Mr. Charlie, please go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you, Twambo. Let me go to Missouri. Missouri, Zebron, you have a comment or a question for George Armstrong with us online this morning.
Yeah, I just pretty much had like the same question that Twambo had, but otherwise, I definitely congratulate the gentleman for going all the way to Zambia to do what you guys are doing. My comment would be like, as you guys stay there, do more. We hope for you guys to publish like, you know, some more stuff. You know, like maybe packaging system way back in Zambia. See if you can have FDA representative go there and then certify some of those things so that you don't have to come all the way here in the United States of America to do other stuff. You know, we have a powerful and hardworking guys that can do most of the stuff that are done here in the United States of America. So that'll be it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a fair point. Josh, I guess my question, or addition to what Zebron and Jumbo had to say, are you considering maybe to bring in any Zambians who could come to start practice or be in some of these universities to see the practices, you know? And I understand your concern when things are just brought from Africa. There is a lot of sometimes misconception. But are you planning to train people, maybe say in an American school, sponsor people we can sponsor over there who can learn to do some of the beautiful things you have done to this honey?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's part of the plan that we've even been talking about more recently is we have now an 8-year history of bringing our students to this place. And you know, we find that even though they're teaching these classes, they are learning so much from the people here. I mean, it's a great cultural experience. It's a great experience that teaches them what it means to be global leaders. But we also need to complete that circle by being able to try to bring some Zambians back to the U.S. and study with us. And so even last week I was speaking with the bishop of the Diocese of Solwezi, which is one of our partners, and talking about scholarships for some of their leaders to come and spend some time at Gonzaga University or in our seminaries and to continue sort of that full circle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Those who have called in online, please, if you want to ask a question, press 1 on your cell pad. And we have 5 or 10 minutes with Josh before he can introduce one of his students to us, so we can speak to him. Josh, other than Zambezi, have you ventured into other districts of Northwestern Province?
You know, I have done some traveling here. One summer we spent 3 months living in Zambia because we were adopting a child who she was abandoned and left to go to an orphanage, and so now she's part of our family. And during that 3-month period, we did travel quite a bit in the Northwest Province, and even around Zambia. I mean, you know, that we had enough time to do some traveling all the way down to Livingston and places in between. And so, and over the course of being here for 8 years, I feel like I've seen different parts of Zambia that I've really appreciated. The geography and the culture that they bring. Obviously, we know the Lunda and the Vali people the best just because we spend time with them, but we've really enjoyed the travels and being able to see such a unique country that somehow is able to peacefully live together with all their tribal cousins and really in many ways is such an example to other African countries.
That's a great... let me invite one last question, and then I'll speak to one of your students. Missouri, Brother Pianki, you have a small comment or question to talk to Josh.
Oh, I have no comments. I'm just listening.
Oh, you're just listening. Okay. Okay, thank you then for that. Okay, Josh, thank you so much. And when do you come back?
We're here until June 10th, I believe, and so we'll have only a little bit more time in Zambezi this week, and then we're going down to Livingston to see the Victoria Falls, and then we'll be heading back up to Lusaka and flying out.
Okay.
So, many of our projects will be wrapping up this week, and so we're doing graduations with our students, and even the, you know, the grade 6 and 7 who have been working on their storytelling will be presenting their books, and others will be doing some final projects. And so it's a very satisfying part of our time here, because we've seen how hard people have worked, and you know, not only how much they've taught us, but how much they've also learned from our projects.
So do you have a Zambian name by now?
Not really, no. They just call me Dr. Joshua. So I don't really have a Zambian name. I wish I could have one, actually.
Okay.
So maybe you'll have to find one for me.
Okay, thank you so much, Josh. And who is your student we're going to talk to again?
Well, we have Connor House. The people here just call him House. And he's been here two times. This is his second time coming out to Zambezi. And he's also been quite involved in the Zambia Honey Project.
Yes.
And so maybe he can talk a little bit about the lessons that he's learned from his time in Zambezi, and also maybe if you have other questions about honey and some of the things that they're doing in the U.S. to try to market that, he would be a great resource.
Oh, great.
So I'll put him on. Here's House.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, Josh. And I will wait for you and talk to you when you come this side of the world.
Hello, this is Connor House.
Connor, how are you, my brother?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. This is Roger. I am in a small town, Okotoks, in the province of Alberta, Canada. And it's nice to see you guys, the work you are doing. So what is your experience you had since coming to Zambia the last two trips are here?
Yes, I came with Dr. Josh and the team last year.
Uh-huh.
I actually taught computer lessons here in Zambia. So I helped with the honey, like Josh said, in the Zambia Gold Honey Project. And so I've been able to see the Chilenga Basic Library that we're helping build, and I've, you know, helped fundraise for that. This year coming back, I'm more of an aide to Dr. Josh and the team. I've been interacting with a lot of the community about the library, getting their feedback, their input, making sure we're doing the library the way that the community wants to. It's been a great experience.
Yeah.
Last year, it was actually my first time leaving the United States, so Zambia was my first foreign country. So I learned a lot about myself and how I interact with different cultures, definitely very quickly.
Yeah, that is funny. I love that you learned about yourself by visiting another country. That's interesting. But I want to hear you. What aspect of Zambian life or Zambezi life do you find very interesting? Mr. House, let me call you House as well. It's much easier.
Yes. Aspects of Zambia, there's so many. Kind of the first thing that comes to my mind is kind of the way that people live in the moment and live in relationships. And, you know, in the U.S. we're so fast-paced and we live by time, and the time on our phones and on our watches. And here, you know, we live with each other, and I can have a conversation with somebody, not worry about running to the next thing. You know, it's very in the moment, and we're very focused on each other and not about the tasks we have or the time constraints we have. So that's a big one, but the people here have also really allowed me, like I said, to dive into a different culture and to learn how I interact with different cultures. Because, like I said, I'd never been outside the country, and I didn't really know what that would look like. But Zambians and people in Zambezi have been very welcoming. We do homestays as a part of this program. And last year I got to go and spend the night at a friend's house in Zambezi, and I got to learn so much about their daily lives, and I can compare that to my daily life in the United States. And so there's so much learning that happens there. I learned a lot about myself when I taught as well, and the people, and how hungry for knowledge they are.
Yeah.
And we see that in the library a lot, too. how that's going to be a beacon for them. And
yes,
they think it's going to be such a magnet for the whole Zambezi district. And that's so inspiring to me.
Mm.
And it really makes me understand the importance of my education and what that means to me and how I can go better improve the world with that education.
Oh, great, great, great. Do you hope from time to time to be going back to this part of Zambia?
I do. I graduate from Gonzaga next year,
okay,
and I'm not sure exactly what I'm doing for that yet, but I have thought about working with the United Nations or with the State Department or with an NGO, and Zambia is a place that I would love to return to someday, and I have many friends here after spending a couple months, people who I'd love to come back and see and continue sharing life with. So I definitely see myself maybe someday making the trek back to Zambezi.
Yeah, definitely it is a well given. I'm sure when you go back to Kazagi, you'll be able to tell the story. We are very interested, as Josh is going to tell you, we are very interested to partner with you guys, a lot of Zambians, to support the honey business. So when you come back to the U.S., I'm going to be getting in touch. So maybe we can start to order a lot of honey in bulk, which we can distribute among the Zambians and many of our friends who can support your business.
Well, that sounds fantastic. We love the support, and especially after seeing the library, we're almost there with the funding, and every little bit's going to help the next few months to get books, to get some electricity out there, and laptops, and to hopefully next summer when Dr. Josh returns, we can have the grand opening, and every little bit helps with that. So we're looking forward to this new partnership.
Okay. No, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And say hello to everyone, and I'll definitely be in touch when you are back in the U.S.
Great. Thank you so much. It was nice talking to you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. So that was... we were speaking to Josh Armstrong, who is in Zambezi, and yes, very very excited. Pianki, what can we do with this project? Let's talk about it a little bit in the time which is remaining. What is coming to your mind to hear people who are bringing honey from Zambezi to Washington State?
Well, it could be, honey could be produced and manufactured, should I say packaged and manufactured there and shipped back to the United States. USDA has agents there in adjacent countries in Africa that can go there and go to your location in Zambia and certify the operation as being organic. The equipment is not that expensive, the centrifuges and so forth and so on, and the packaging. We have a friend in Ghana that's exporting for Ghana, importing back into the United States some herbal-grown products that are certified as organic. So as someone earlier mentioned,
what value
as you possibly can. Pardon me?
Yeah, so what should be our strategy, Bianchi? I think in the first place, we may have to encourage them to bring this honey from these farmers. What I'm going to be organizing, there was a gentleman I was supposed to bring on, he wasn't available from Kabompo, is to see this productivity go up. Let them bring the raw honey here. But at one point, I'll be speaking to Josh to see how we can phase this production or processing, further processing or packaging. Twambo talked about it's beautiful packaging, by the way, back to Kabompo or back to Zambezi. But for now, Zebro, how do we support these guys? I think we need to support them to support our own people. Because for me, I'm I'm seeing a library in Kasempa, I'm seeing a library in Kabompo, I'm seeing a library in Minlunga being built by the honey industry.
Well, that was my suggestion. I wouldn't make it a full-fledged operation myself. Improbable. Mm-hmm. I would take the profits and build, you know, trade schools. Well, you can give people skills, whereas they can be able to market those skills in order to increase their family wealth, their personal development. And that would be me. I would build a building, equip it with the equipment, take the honey in as they do every place else, and do all the manufacturing process in there.
Twombo, what are your thoughts here?
Okay.
Okay.
My thoughts are that I was pleasantly surprised at the packaging, as I said. I mean, I buy, when I'm in Lusaka,
yeah,
I buy honey from the supermarkets, and it is, you can buy it in the glass jars, as he mentioned, or you can get it in these plastic bottles that you can squeeze. But the packaging that they have, you know, on the website is very modern, very appealing to the eye, you know. And I wish that is something that was done, that we did more of in Zambia for all of our products. My only concern is this, you know, organic certification. And I think that is what stops a lot of people in Zambia actually making products that they can export. Because if you remember, I had this lady called Glenda on the show before, and she was talking about the Green Expo she was going to have in Lusaka. And she was talking about how hard it was for small farmers who are interested in exporting, you know, dried mango and their vegetables and things like that, how expensive it was and how they just didn't know how to go about the organic certification. So I think that is one thing we're going to have to tackle first as a nation, is how can we get organic certification so that young people or small-scale farmers that are interested in exporting their goods, how can they do that? And then also we would need to work on setting up some good, you know, packaging plants or something like that, because as was mentioned by Pauline last week, the problem that we have is packaging. You know, there's so many things that we could export in Africa, in Zambia, but how we package it to be appealing to the eye so that you could be able to export it, that is one of the biggest problems we have. So I think if we are to help this project, we need to first work on how can we make the organic certification easier and how can we work on the packaging. That, those are my thoughts.
Very, very insightful. Dr. Patrick, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the two gentlemen we spoke to. They are in Zambezi district of Zambia, from Washington State. They are producing organic honey, so to say, but their quality of packaging, Dr. Patrick, is just amazing. Twombo, I went to the flea market last week, and I was looking at the jars, even in Walmart. I go to Walmart, the way they are packaged, the way everything is done, compared to what we are seeing on the website. It is way, way, way advanced. And yet that is Zambian honey, which is packaged like that. Dr. Patrick, the question, you talk about standards and certification a lot. You heard what Twombo had to say. How can we get our friends in Washington State to begin to certify our organic honey? Let it be done in Zambia and not in the United States, and be acceptable to be sold in the United States.
There are a couple of ways to approach it. There are three ways to approach it. The European way, regional way, and the United States way. If you go through, and this, I'm addressing the organic certification.
Mm.
For all three, EU, United States, and regionally, they have different standards when it comes to certification. If you go the EU way, in order to get your product certified, it's under a system called ISO. It's ISO that have various EU systems in which they will send inspectors to train and to make sure that you are certifiable. This course, they will charge you exorbitant amount of money in order to certify your products to be exported into the EU member countries. In the United States, there is no certification process for organic products, and as generally for foods. What you need to do is you need to know and meet the standards and regulations of that particular product. Each particular product has different standards and different regulations, and once you meet that, then you can export your product into the United States. With respect to regional, each country have different standards and regulations, so you must know the standards and regulations. Now, it is the United States' position at this particular time is to demonstrate your capacity to export products regionally first. This also gives you a market base, and this also gives you a standing with respect to a business plan, showing proof that you can successfully export your products regionally, and in turn, you've established a investment position and investment standing. Specifically with certification is do not be misled when one say a product is organic and a product is inorganic. The difference generally is that you're not applying pesticides or insecticides that may remain in your products. If you do, then the product is not organic. However, there is something else that happens if you do not mine your particular products. And in this case, we're talking about honey. In this particular case, there are limits of amount of insect fragments, bees in particular, that can be found in honey. That's a standard in which the United States must be warranted and must address. Also, there is a mycotoxin, the various mycotoxins, that's mold, in which is, if not adhered to, might find its way into a product or might find its way into honey and therefore create a undesirous position, which is a poison, a toxic poison. So these are the incidents that may be prevalent and can be found. There's also the component of metals. If metals are found in an area where beehives are found. So these are conditions that must be addressed and it must be looked at before it is exported regionally, EU and to the United States. With respect to packaging, you also have standards concerning packaging. Standards whether or not if it's a plastic packaging, standards whether or not if it's cardboard packaging, standards whether or not if it's a glass packaging, or if it is paper packaging. All of these packagings must be sealed and must be properly contained. Whenever you talk about packaging, you also talk about labeling. It must be properly labeled. And all of this would go into the successful export and sustainability of a particular product, of honey in particular. So all of this should be addressed. Now, of course, you can individually, and some of our brothers and sisters from the African countries, as well as from EU and from Mexico, bring it in via their bags and luggages, and then they sell it to local stores. However, if this is done and the local store happened to be inspected by a vendor, from that point on, there'll be more eyes will be attuned to that particular store. Another thing about that is, if this is brought in by individual packaging in cartons and crates, and the announcement is not made that the product is, or the honey is being used for marketing purposes, one will never be able to make an appreciable amount of money that one would like to make. If you consider making $50,000 or $100,000, maybe $200,000 a year, then the risk can be taken, but you're not making any money. You're comparing $200,000 to $50,000, $500,000, up to $1 million plus, if you were to address the standards and meet the requirements therein. So it's not quick, and it is intensive, but yet and still, the worth, it's well worth to meet the standards and regulations, and profit wise, it's well worth it. And for the individual, the company, and the country, it is well worth it.
Yes. Well said, Dr. Patrick. That was one of Twumbo's question as to why is the processing being done in Washington State? This is Zambezi honey instead of processing it. From what you have said, Dr. Patrick, therefore, what should be our strategy as Zambians who are living in diaspora? Is it to make sure that this the honey begins to be processed in Zambia, or maybe we should first and foremost support this market, this product which has been brought over here, help them sell as much as possible, so that that library in Zambezi is completed, and maybe it can begin to affect it in other libraries being built in Kabompo, Munilunga. What should be our strategy be at this point? Taking back production to Zambia, or help marketing of this product here in North America and around the world?
Give me a little background about the Washington. We're talking about Washington State Project in
yes.
the United States.
Washington State Project, I talked to them. They were online here, Josh Armstrong. He is in Zambezi, and they collect honey there from the farmers, the honey farmers, and
mm-hmm.
then they bring it in drum to Washington State. The university is called, some funny name, where is it? I wrote it somewhere. For a university, is it Guantan University? And they package it very, very well, and
okay.
it gets certification. It is certified as organic. Trumbo's question to Josh Armstrong was, why can't this product be processed in Zambezi rather than bring it to North America? His answer was because there are certification processes, which quite lengthy, the way you have explained it, sounds a little bit complicated, and I'm thinking at this point we may not meet those standards yet, considering our structures back in Zambia. Therefore, we are conflicted here. Should we be more interested in developing this place to process Zambian honey in Zambezi, or should we just partner with these people to market the honey which is being processed in Washington State?
I'm thinking a partnership / a PPT partnership. P being private, P being public, T being training or educational process. One thing is when you look at the Washington Zambezi connection as you mentioned, one thing that I would keenly look at is what they are speaking of with respect to certification, meaning that who certified the product. It's not the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in which we're talking about, in which I'm talking about standards and regulations. So therefore, you have to look at who is the I would like to look at who is certifying these products. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the partnership having to do with training these individuals, they've most likely established a shipping agreement. And this shipping agreement can be dovetailed into Zambians who are living in the Zambezi area, in which they can begin to develop a market so that they could be able to be sellers of the product, not only to the Washington, but also to region as well as to other places in the United States. So that connection is there. Another reason why it's good to have a public-private partnership is that it is important that the province is engaged in this type of partnership, because when you export products, as well as the government is also important, because when you export products, you're going to be exporting products from not only the Zambezi area district, you're exporting it from the province, and you're exporting it from Zambia. And sometime around the period of exporting, if the market or when the market expands to become lucrative in marketing Zambezi honey, there will be an inspection. And that inspection comes from the Food and Drug Administration. And they will visit the facility. They won't visit the facility. They will call on the Zambian government. And with the Zambian government, they'll begin to inspect the facility. So right now, my suggestion is to start as a complete package, not only the Washington Zambezi Project, but the local Zambezi Project and the academia in Zambezi, well as the government.
Dr. Patrick, you're absolutely right. That's what I would do, too, rather than making it a little ragtag operation. And,
yeah.
Roger, me, myself, I'm not interested in honey whatsoever. But I tell you what, if you're really interested in how to do that the correct way, you know, I would be more willing to talk to you and connect you not only with some people with USDA, but also a very formidable market here in the States.
Not USDA.
So that's up to you.
Not USDA, FDA.
Yeah, FDA, Food and Drug Administration. Well, in order to get the – I mean, everything you said so far has been very accurate and very thorough. But it doesn't it could be a much bigger operation where putting a Zambian in business themselves where they can get the passport to come over here. And I mean, why would you have a distribution way up in the northwest corner? Distribution should be there in the Gulf area, I would say.
Yeah,
but anyway.
I was just saying that being that they have a channel, a commerce channel up there, you can start there.
Right.
But basically, one needs to sit down and put together a business plan to fold all of it together.
And, Roger, you would look more better in the Gulf than you do up there in Toronto now.
It's true. But I think I agree with Dr. Patrick. These people have already made the first step to go in rural Zambia. They've made the first step. They've made that channel, Pianki, to bring to Northwest. The people in the Gulf don't know about Zambia. We are not probably interested to go to Zambia. These people have. So I think our link is to find out how we can. And if you are also saying you could be on board to see how many more places we can distribute this honey. I'm in business. I'm in business. This is any Zambian listening this morning, if you are willing to be part of the distributing centers, we will be in touch with you, and we will sell this honey and build libraries, build schools in Zambia using this library. This was
Roger,
your show.
Roger,
we are going. Sorry, Dr. Patrick. I've run out of time.
Okay,
I'm going
alrighty.
Straight to Nathan. Nathan, I'm sorry. Thank you. Next show.